yourself.
Jake Smogholic.
Hi, Jason.
I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. My sobriety date is September 26, 1992. My home group is the Midtown Group in Bethesda, Maryland. And I was talking to Sam. The last time I was here was Super Bowl night 2008. And so it's good to be back amongst friends. And I was telling Sam, funny, you know, I came here, I agreed to speak, and then realized it was Super Bowl night. And, of course, as I'm taught in AA, you know, we do what we say we're going to do. It's not like I've seen my home groups on Sunday night, so it's not like I've seen a Super Bowl live in many years. But, you know, I got down here and spoke. Got in my car, did not turn on the radio, got all the way back, and I was living in a condo at the time, and I walked in the lobby, and the TV was showing the score, and I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me, you know, and, we do what we got to do here, you know, and again, I'm grateful to be here. I think it's pretty fairly obvious I got sober young. I got sober about a month after my 16th birthday, and, I had a good run at it, you know. I grew up in a fairly normal home, you know, nothing to complain about. I had loving parents. I had, an older brother. I had no real reason to drink, you know. But I always, and this doesn't make me an alcoholic, but, I always felt anxious. You know, I've always had kind of a nervous disposition, you know, and when I finally drank, I was about 10 or 11 years old, I'm not exactly sure. It was the first thing I had experienced in my life that had relieved that, you know. Sometimes, you know, I could get caught up in the moment of something, you know, and I could forget about, you know, that anxiety and that nervousness. But alcohol, it was, you know, like Bill talks about, you know, it was like, it was a discovery, you know what I mean? I had an experience that night, you know, and I didn't even intend to drink, you know. I went to a friend of mine's dad's Christmas party, you know, and we started drinking the punch, not realizing there was something in it, you know, and, I just remember figuring that out fairly quickly and drinking more, and, I just remember laughing a lot, you know, and then I just stopped remembering, you know, and that kind of set a pattern for my drinking, you know. I tend to drink to excess at any opportunity, you know, and even when I intend not to, you know, and I tend to black out, usually eventually pass out, you know, and early on in my drinking that didn't really pose many problems. People were usually pretty tolerant, you know, they would put me somewhere that was comfortable, you know, they'd put me on a couch or a bed. And I just wake up the next morning, you know, and no consequences whatsoever, you know. And at that age, you know, it's not like I turned around and became a daily drinker, you know. I knew from that point, you know, that I wanted to drink, you know. And it was, you know, I. It's kind of weird, you know. You know, I have this nervous disposition, you know, and which has always caused me to want to appear to do well at things, you know, without, I don't really want to do the work, I just want to, like, do well, you know, and school always came fairly easy to me, you know, and I always did really well, I got straight A's all growing up, you know, and but I had so much anxiety about it, you know, all the time, you know, but I was always at the same time very attracted to things I wasn't supposed to be doing, you know, and So even when I wasn't drinking, you know, I, around that age, even on nights we couldn't get anything, I would sneak out of my parents' house and kind of cause havoc around the neighborhood. You know, I've always, like I said, been attracted to that, you know, and a friend of mine says, you know, from the moment he took a drink, he was attracted to the sound of breaking glass and screeching tires, you know, and I can relate to that, you know. So I'd sneak out of my house and, you know, we would do dumb stuff that teenagers do, some vandalism and things like that. And the funny thing is, when I started drinking, I didn't really have as much need to do that. You know, I became more interested in drinking, you know, and so we would, every once in a while, we would, we'd get together, and we would raid somebody's parents' liquor cabinet, and I mean, everything about it, not just the drinking, I loved everything about it, you know. I loved picking the container that it was going to go in, you know. I loved, sneaking through the house after the parents had gone to bed and, pouring. I mean, we were amateurs, you know. We'd pour, like, a little bit of everything into the same container, you know. And, it'd be like gin and vermouth mixed together, you know, and it would be nasty, you know. And we would sneak off into the woods and, it would usually be like a mason jar or something. And, you know, just a few of us, and we would pass it around and we'd smoke cigarettes. And I love the ritual of it, you know, almost as much as I like the effect, you know. And so, again, I had really no consequences. It just seemed like when I drank, things came easier, you know. Like I could actually have a conversation with people. It seemed like I was funnier, you know. I don't know if that's actually true. Maybe I was just funnier to myself. But, you know, it seemed like I could get along with others, and I've always been, very introverted, you know, and haven't really had an easy time with other people. But when I drank, all of that, you know, wasn't a problem, you know, and so, like I said, I enjoyed drinking, I did a fair amount of other things as well at a young age. It seemed that some of that was easier to come by, and I think some of that, you know, got me here a little bit quicker. But my focus was always drinking. You know, I always it always started and ended with drinking for me. You know, my drinking story is fairly short, and it's not terribly exciting. You know, I never drank in bar rooms. You know, I never got a DUI. I'd never driven before I got sober. You know, I think I'd driven once illegally, but I didn't have a driver's license. You know, I didn't have a car. I'd obviously never lost a marriage. I used to say I never lost a job. That wasn't true. I actually lost a job the very last night I drank, because of my drinking, I had not been kicked out of school, although that was purely on a technicality, so I had these, you know, list of things when I got to AA that seemed like, were reasons I would try to relate out, you know, that people would tell these horrible stories, you know, especially like the really great circuit speakers, you know, generally have these horrific stories, you know, and that just wasn't my experience, you know. I drank and went to high school, and I was probably the kid who, if you were in my crowd of friends, I was the one that their parents would be like, you should be more like Jason, you know, because I got good grades all through my drinking pretty much, you know, And on the outside, I appeared to be doing okay most of the time, you know. But my friends were like in and out of rehabs, but I never got caught. Like I just never got caught, you know. I had so many narrow escapes, you know, from that. I had very strict rules for myself. I never brought anything into my parents' house. You know, I felt like that was just dumb, you know. And my friends did it all the time. They would get caught and sent to rehab. But I was the guy, like, as soon as your son got a rehab, I was calling him and being like, dude, we need to celebrate, you know, that you got through 60 days of rehab or 90 days or whatever. And so probably the guy getting him to relapse, you know. And so it's not like I was a good influence. It just appeared that I was, you know. You know, but again, I had no consequences for the first few years of my drinking. And then, you know, people kind of got tired of putting me in bed or on a couch, and I just started doing the same thing I always did, you know, which was blackout, pass out, and I would just wake up places, you know. And so I'd wake up, you know, in a field, a soccer field, or, you know, because I drank a lot in fields and woods and parks, you know. So I'd wake up in the park, or every once in a while I'd wake up in the median of a road, you know, and not really know how I got there, or a cemetery, you know, and you know, I'd come out of a blackout, and I remember one night I came out of a blackout, and I was line dancing in a country western bar, not even sure how I got in there. It was probably the only time I ended up in a bar drinking, and if you know anything about me, like, I'm not into country western at all, and so I was very, very confused, you know, you know, and I had started the night, well, I started actually the day at this girl's sweet 16 birthday party in Arlington, you know, and I think I was probably like 14 or 15 at the time, and an older friend of mine was dating this girl, and we were the only two people drinking at this party. Like, everybody else was just, you know, being wholesome, good teenagers, I guess. And we got kicked out for getting caught drinking behind her shed, and which didn't go over well because he was her boyfriend. And we got caught by their dad, I think. And so we got thrown out. And then I came out of this blackout in this country western bar, you know. And then I went back into a blackout. And next thing I know, I'm, you know, coming out of a blackout again, kind of being, I guess you could say, thrown out of a car that wasn't quite stopped back in Arlington, Virginia. And I found out later that that bar was, you know, a good 30, 40 miles from where I started, you know, and not quite sure what happened in between, you know. And that's the kind of stuff that happens to me when I drink, you know, and you know, and often nothing happens, you know. And so I'd go months with no consequences, and then I would have a night like that, you know. And or I'd, you know, I would say this is an accurate statement, that every time I've seen a gun in my life has been when I was drinking, you know. And you know, I remember one night we were riding our bikes through the neighborhood, you know, bicycles, not like motorcycles, you know, because I'm 14 or 15 again, and we would often drink and ride our bicycles places, you know. And apparently I passed out mid-riding and just kind of fell over, and my friends were just sitting around seeing if I'd come to. And and there was two larger gentlemen standing over me, and one was holding up his shirt to show me his gun. And it became very clear pretty quickly that he wanted my bicycle, you know. And you know, if I was sober, I'm sure I would have given him my bicycle, you know. I would have been terrified, you know. And but drinking, you know, impairs my judgment, you know, and like it does for everybody that drinks too much, you know, and you don't have to be alcoholic for that to happen. And, you know, I find myself having a conversation with this guy, and the conversation went something like, do you really want my bicycle, or are you just looking for transportation? You know, and then I went back into a blackout and kind of, you know, I don't know, I have no idea how much time passed, but I came back out of the blackout and I'm standing on my bike pedaling and he's sitting on the seat, you know, and so. You know, basically the premise is that strange things happen when I drink, you know, and then like by the time I drop him off, he's like, "You're a cool guy," you know, like, and just parted ways, you know, and I mean it was just bizarre, you know, and I'm pretty much, you know, at this point, like I said, I never got caught for drinking, but I would get caught for things like, you know, getting taken home by the police at like 2 a.m. on a Tuesday, you know, on a school night. And, you know, so pretty quickly, that happened a fair number of times, and my parents nailed the window of my room shut. And so I just found a different way out of the house, you know, and, my sneaking out became just more elaborate, you know, and I remember, one night we had, you know, we had gone and we had stolen a bunch of alcohol out of somebody's, you know, somebody's dad's garage that we knew, and, he had inherited a bunch from, like, his father when he had passed away, and so his garage was just, like, full of cases of alcohol, you know. So we broke into the garage one night. We didn't even tell, like, our friend who was his son, you know. We just broke in. And we stole some alcohol, you know, and I'm, you know, driving, or not driving, biking down the road, you know, and I see the sirens behind me, and I'm like, oh, God, you know. Because I can hear my backpack just going, like, clink, 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 you know, and I take off, you know, and I'm like, I'm going to outrun a cop car on a bicycle, you know, again, fair judgment. And I pull into a place that, like, ends up in a dead end, you know, and it's a fence, you know. I throw my bike over the fence, and, of course, I get caught, you know. And I'm riding the whole way home, and I'm like, I don't know why. I just seem to always get out of trouble, you know. Some reason he never asks what's in my backpack, you know, and I just get dropped off. I mean, I get in trouble for being out, but I, you know, I toss my backpack like in the bushes next to the front door before I even go into my house, you know, so I don't get called by my parents either, you know, but I'm always just like narrowly missing, you know, somehow, and, you know, but I'm also like, I also have always looked younger than I actually am, so I could, you know, if I really needed to get out of trouble, you know, I could turn on the waterworks or something, you know, and kind of, you know, talk my way out of something, you know, with the cops, you know, because I'm always running into them, you know, early on in my drinking, you know, when I was kind of more into the whole vandalism thing, you know, I remember one night I was out in the neighborhood and we were drinking and I had a drill, and I'm not proud of this, but I was drilling holes in cars because I was bored. A cop comes and I had a whole conversation with the cop with the drill behind my back, you know, and he's, by the end of the conversation, it's, you know, he's in the car and I'm just standing behind a car with drill behind my back. And, you know, he's like, you know, you really shouldn't be out here. There's somebody vandalizing cars in this neighborhood. And I was like, thank you. Good to know. I'll go home, you know. And I don't know why. You know, he just never asked me what's behind my back, you know. I guess I just have one of those faces, you know, that people don't want to, you know, get me in trouble. So many countless times where, you know, I could have been arrested for something, you should have been arrested for something, and just wasn't, you know, and, uh, And, by the time I'm probably, 14 or 15, I'm drinking pretty regular. By the time I'm 15, I'm drinking almost every day, and I am, I'm showing up to high school, and still doing pretty well, not quite as well as I was, but I'm, I'm thinking when I'm drinking, this isn't normal, Like, it's fairly obvious, I'm drinking to overcome a craving, like it talks about in her book. I wouldn't have put it in those words, but even when I would set out to just have a couple, I would always overshoot the mark, and I would feel sometimes remorseful about actions I took, and I would think, even the next day, I'm not going to drink today, or maybe it's, I'm not going to drink for a little while, and sometimes it was just that I felt physically bad. I would feel like I wasn't going to. And, something happens, where a few hours go by, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I overreacted. It wasn't that bad, And then a few more hours go by, and it's, well, maybe I'll just call my friends and see what's happening tonight, And then a few hours go by, and I'm out with my friends, but I'm not going to drink. And then I find myself drinking, and that's, really how my drinking was at the end is, often I was not, planning to drink, and I would find myself doing it, and then I would feel remorseful about that, and I would think, I kind of got to the point where I was really kind of a bummer to be around when I drank, because sometimes I would just end up like crying or something, it was just kind of a downer, and people didn't really want to drink around me, and so I really only drank with, four or five friends that drank kind of like I did. My world became smaller and smaller, and I would go to high school, and I would probably my sophomore year of high school, I probably didn't eat lunch 95% of the days because I would take the, I think it was $2.15 for lunch back then, and my parents would give me the exact amount. And if I could get an extra 12 cents, I could get the cheapest six-pack of malt liquor they sold at the corner store next to my high school, which would sell alcohol to anybody, And I walk in there and I get a six pack of King Cobra malt liquor, which is just disgusting. And it would be like warm. It wouldn't even be refrigerated, And I would go down to the woods across the street from my high school and I would drink it. And then I would go to French class, And then I'd probably do something after school. And then I'd really like get drunk on the weekends, The last summer I had of drinking, I was, it was just kind of a blur, It was the summer between my sophomore and junior year high school, and every one of my friends, was in summer school except for me, So I, and my mom, kind of cut me off financially. She said if I wanted like an allowance or anything, I either had to get a job or I had to volunteer. So I was too lazy to get a job. So she had me volunteer at this homeless shelter near my house. So I'd go there and I would generally just sit around and talk to the guys that live there, about my escapades from the previous night. And a lot of times I would get comments like, dude, you really shouldn't drink. And I'm thinking, you live in a homeless shelter and you're telling me I shouldn't drink, right? Like, I'm not thinking that doesn't reflect well upon me, And then I would spend my afternoons, like, waiting for my friends to get out of school in the park near my parents' house, drinking with the guys that actually lived in the park, And then I would wait for my friends to get out of school and then I'd start drinking with them, again, the summer was kind of blur, and kind of went into my junior year. And it was very evident, you know, I was not going to make it through high school. Like, I knew it. I knew, even though I was still kind of holding it together, I just couldn't do it another 2 years, you know. And so I went in with, this time I had like another firm resolution, you know, I'm only going to drink on weekends, you know. And I think I was like 3 days in and I was drinking, you know. And 3 weeks into that year, you know, I went to the first school dance of the year. No intention of going in the dance, you know, because that would be lame, I guess. And what I'm doing is I'm drinking out in the woods or the parking lot, you know. And I don't even know. People have told me I drank quite a bit. Didn't seem like that much more than a normal night for me, you know. But I ended up passing out in the soccer field of my high school. You know, and it just happened to be kind of cold that night and raining, and somebody ended up finding me at some point because my friends had left me there, because that was not unusual for me to pass out somewhere, and somebody else found me, and they apparently I wasn't looking too good, so they drug me about a block away to this restaurant I worked at, which is how I got fired, because I started throwing up all over the restaurant, passed out, right? And they ended up calling an ambulance, and I didn't find out till much later I had been fired, like, while I was not conscious. I ended up at the hospital. I ended up in Arlington Hospital in an alcohol-induced coma, and, hypothermia, and that was the first time my parents caught me drinking, you know, and so that was a good time, and that was fun to explain, and, so I came to at some point, I remember seeing, you know, the faces of my family, you know, standing there. The disappointment, and the terror, really, more than anything. I ended up okay, but, I was really physically sick, you know, and so I ended up spending, like, in the next probably week in bed, and got suspended from high school. The only reason I didn't get expelled is because I didn't technically get picked up on school property, which was the technicality of why I didn't. Because another friend of mine who I was drinking with also ended up in the hospital that night, and he did get expelled because his ambulance picked him up on school property. And I ended up home, sick, didn't really have any thoughts about drinking. I just knew that, you know, I needed a break, you know. But my mom was sober in AA. You know, I knew about AA. She had been sober for a few years at that point, and it wasn't even her first time in AA. So I'd known about AA for quite a while. And a friend of mine who I drank with, his sister was also sober in the home group I'm in now. And, we used to hang out at his house all the time when I was drinking. And I would hang out with AA people, and didn't really faze me, you know, that I would be drunk or high and hanging out with them. So I knew a lot of people. I even knew a lot of young people in AA, you know. I don't really remember a lot of that week, but I do. My mom has told me since then that we had a whole conversation about, like, you either need to go to rehab or AA, and I told her I wasn't going to do either. So I was defiant still, you know. Sometime that next week, about a week after I'd been home, it was a Tuesday, and I was thinking, like, how can I get out of here to get a drink, you know, and it scared me, you know, and that was probably the longest I'd been sober for a little while, and it was mostly because I was just so physically sick, you know, and I got a phone call, and it was actually that friend whose sister was in AA, you know, and he said, you know, and I kind of wondered what happened to him because I hadn't seen him all that summer, you know, and turned out he'd been sober for a few months in AA, you know, and he said I had heard about what happened, and everybody in my high school had heard about what happened, you know. I spent the next 2 years of high school known as Coma Boy, you know, he said I heard about what happened, and you know, I've been sober for 2 months in AA, you know, would you like to go to a meeting? And I, you know, if he had called me probably a day before, I probably would have said no, you know, and if he called me a day later, I don't know if I'd still been, you know, if I'd already been drinking again, you know, and it's, you know, the same thing you hear in really everybody's story in AA is that what happened part, you know, and it's really about those, you know, seconds and inches, you know, that if things had just not worked out just the right way, you know, we might not be here, you know, just like it had done so for, Roland Hazard, followed by Abby, followed by Bill, and then Dr. Bob, you know, all these things had to line up just right, you know, for them to get sober, you know, and then touch favorably on the life of somebody else, you know, you know, so I said okay, and you know, and he did what most newer AAs when they're trying to help somebody else, he got like a little too excited, you know, and he was like, great, we're, you know, there's a meeting right next to your house, we can, you know, it's tonight, and I was like, oh, you know, hold on a second, you know, so we, that was a Tuesday, we made plans for Friday, you know, and somehow I stayed sober, you know, you know, I ended up going to this meeting, with him, and, you know, he's still sober to this day as well, you know, you know, we ended up going to this meeting, the guy who picked us up is still sober, you know, he took us to a meeting, you know, drove from Arlington, to Chevy Chase, Maryland for a meeting. And it seemed like, I don't know why you would go to Chevy Chase, Maryland for a meeting, you know, but that's what people do, you know. I mean, they take you where the message is, you know. You know, he brought us to an active group of young people, and I don't remember anything from that meeting, you know, like not a word, you know. But, you know, this guy, he said, here's this guy, he's going to give you a ride home. You know, and I never met this guy at all, you know, and he's still sober today as well, you know, and so he gave me a ride home, and I'm sure his idea of a good Friday night was not to take a belligerent 16-year-old home, but that's what he did, you know, and he was, you know, 27 at the time, you know, so I'm sure as well he didn't really want to be hanging out with a 16-year-old kid. And I just kind of stared out the window, and he attempted to do what it talks about in working with others, which is, you know, he tried to tell me stories about himself. He even tried to tell funny stories, and I just kind of stared out the window. But he did do something when I got home. You know, he said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" You know, I was out of plans. You know what I mean? And that's a great place to be at if you're newly sober, you know, is just to be out of plans, you know, and I just didn't have another idea, you know what I mean? I felt just defeated, you know, and so I agreed, I just said nothing, you know, and he said, great, you know, I'll be at your house tomorrow, you know, and we went, he picked me up and he took me to this afternoon meeting in Georgetown in D.C., And we met up with some other people there. I remember we went down to the waterfront after the meeting. I remember thinking my life was over, you know, like this, like I just couldn't think of anything lamer, you know. Like we were hanging out on the waterfront, you know. I looked around and all these guys, you know, they were probably all in their mid-20s, you know, and they were wearing like, khakis and polo shirts or like Oxford shirts, and I'm like a 16-year-old, literally punk kid, like wearing all black, you know, and black Doc Martens, you know, and I had a shaved head, and I had earrings, you know, and I had a ring that was a skull with spikes coming out of it, so I was really an approachable person, right, like that. And I just remember looking around and thinking, you know, I'm trapped in a Dockers commercial, you know, and like, I just couldn't think of anything lamer, you know, and, you know, but these guys, like, when they would talk about drinking, you know, they knew what they were talking about, you know, and I could relate, you know, it was, and there was something about people in AA, as much as I judged them, you know, and I did judge them. I was not a happy newcomer, you know. And there was something about them. There was a light in their eyes, you know. They had, you know, talks in the book about, like, their whole deportment shouts that they have an answer, right? They found an answer, you know. And that was really what was more attractive to me than what they said, you know, was there was something about them that they looked comfortable in their own skin, you know, and I didn't feel that way, you know. But I sat in meetings and I think, you know, like, I would hear this. First time I heard this, some of the slogans, I was like, how dumb are you people, right? Like, I mean, these, like, this is so, like, really, first things first, really? Like, we really have to go there, you know? And, I mean, duh, right? Like, so I just felt, inwardly, I just felt superior, you know? But then my sponsor would be like, clean up the cigarette butts, and I'd be like, okay, you know, and he brought me to, well, what is my home group, you know, then, and he brought me to another meeting that day, you know, and then he brought me like a couple the next day, and I ended up at my home group, and he said, you know, why don't you sweep up cigarette butts, you know, and I ended up doing that for a year, you know, and then, you know, he started making coffee at a Friday night meeting. And I hadn't even asked him to be my sponsor yet, but he, you know, he brought me along, you know, and I just started making coffee, you know. And I got swept up in the fellowship of AA way before, you know, I really got interested in the solution of the program, you know. And I just started going to a lot of meetings. I mean, my sponsor took me to a lot of meetings, you know, you know, he would say, you know, if you're not in school or you're not working, go to, you know, at least two meetings a day, you know. And so I went to a meeting every night, and then on weekends I would go to two, three, sometimes four meetings on each day, you know, and you know, spent a lot of time with people in AA. I had nothing else going on in my life, you know, and I would hang out, you know, at the coffee shop after the meeting, and, you know, come home late, you know, and do it all over again, you know, you know, and then I started to hear things in the meetings, or my sponsor would start to say things, you know, and I started relating to what people's experience, you know, and it really, you know, I realized it really wasn't so much about the circumstances of my drinking is not what made me alcoholic, you know, sometimes, you know, telling our stories can help somebody relate to some specific circumstances, but that isn't what makes me an alcoholic, you know. What makes me alcoholic is, you know, what it talks about in We Agnostics, you know, when I honestly want to, I can't quit entirely, or if when drinking I have little control over the amount I take, I'm probably an alcoholic, you know. And both of those things were true from the very first time I took a drink, you know. And they were true all through my drinking, you know, and that is a great equalizer here, you know. It doesn't matter, you know, what all that other stuff, you know. I don't have to have gone to jail. I don't have to have been arrested. It's fine if I have, you know. It's almost like you're more popular in AA the worse your story is, you know. But, you know, I ended up, you know, in this active home group and, you know, doing a lot of service, going to a ton of meetings, you know, and my sponsor, you know, he didn't push the book right at the beginning, you know, he let me catch my feet a little bit, but he got me, you know, interested, you know, and so I did the fourth and fifth step, you know, And for me, you know, once I'd done that fifth step, I honestly took a step back, you know, and I didn't really progress that much in the program. I got really involved in service, you know, and I got really involved in the fellowship. But I kind of hung at 6 and 7 and not really even doing that, you know. And when I was about 3 years sober, you know, I'm very active from a fellowship and service standpoint. I went, there was a bunch of people, I was involved in like young people's stuff, and we were going to Ikepa and Hawaii that year, and some of my friends were like, wouldn't it be cool if we went for like a month? And then it ended up being like, wouldn't it be cool if we went for the whole summer? And I was like, all right, you know, I'll go. And I went with these guys who were not really my normal crowd in my, you know, because I'm in a big home group, you know, and it wasn't really my normal crowd. It was kind of guys that had been sober a little longer than I had and were probably a little bit better grounded, and ended up going to Hawaii for the summer with these guys. And I had no idea how little of a third step I had until I'd done that. You know, because we got there, and we had one car and 8 people, you know. And you want to find out, you know, how much you have away, you know, you try to get 7 other people to agree with your way, you know. And because if you wanted to do something, 7 other people were going to have to agree with you. And it was a painful experience for me, you know. I was so miserable, you know, and I'm in paradise, right? And I was just like, I was so miserable, you know, and these guys seemed to be having, like, they seemed to, you know, be friends. They had been friends for years, you know, and they seemed to, you know, just be having a good time, and I was just in hell, you know, and we'd go to meetings, you know, and I wasn't telling any of them, you know, how I was feeling, you know, and of course, but I would get an hour-long phone call, before cell phones were prevalent, and I would get an hour-long phone call, and I would sneak off to a cell phone or a payphone every Sunday, and I would call my sponsor back home, you know, and I don't know why I was called on Sundays, because he was always out of town, like he was always at the beach or something. But I would get his sponsor, who he lived with, you know, and I would, like, 5 minutes into it, I would start crying, right? And I would basically cry for 55 minutes until it would say, like, your time is, like, about to expire, right? And my grand sponsor would say, like, all right, I'll talk to you next Sunday. Like, he just expected the phone call, you know? He'd be like, just hang in there, you know? And then I ran out of money prematurely, you know, like a month in. So that wasn't good. So I had to find this job. Me and another guy, he also needed money, but not as badly as I did. So we showed up to this job. And it was horrible. It was like telemarketing for trying to get donations for the Honolulu Lions Club. And it was really bad and like smoke-filled office. And just the whole thing was kind of shady. We went to lunch the first day, and the guy I'm with, you know, he's like, I'm not going back, but you have to. And I was just like, because he had a little bit of money left, but I had none, you know. And I was like, so I went to this job, and we were living on up in the mountains in Oahu, and it was the only way to get up and down was the Pali Highway. So I'd have to walk into Honolulu on the Pali Highway in the morning, and then I'd walk back in the afternoon. And I usually, like, I'd be walking up the side of a highway, basically. And people would throw their trash at me, you know. It was just, like, I was feeling like a real winner, you know. And then I finally, like, something happened, you know, where I just kind of let it go, you know what I mean? And I just started doing what I had to do, you know, and I started being okay with not getting my way, you know, and I started being okay with, you know, not having to be in control of everything all the time. And I really didn't realize, like, I had not had a third step, you know, for 3 years being here, you know, and I had a great time, you know, and for the rest of the time I was there, you know. And it really, you know, it became about, you know, what can I was all, my whole life I've looked for what can I get out of a situation, you know, always, you know, is what can I get out of this, you know. And first time in my life I was looking up what could I bring into a situation, you know. And I came back and, again, you know, been, ever since been, you know, involved in a active home group and, you know, I don't have a lot of time, you know, but, you know, I got busy, you know, I, you know, finished my amends, you know, and I'm sure there's, and, you know, even when I think I'm done, I'm not, you know, because I've had times where I've stepped backwards, you know, I had made amends to my parents, and I had a summer where I didn't, you know, my behavior was not, you know, very spiritual. And, you know, at one point, you know, my mom, who's in AA, you know, said something about, like, basically, like, I don't really, you know, it's almost like you owe me amends again, you know what I mean? Because I just, you know, I can get off the beam here, you know, and I'm never finished, you know, growing here. You know, I always have to, you know, remain teachable. And it talks in the book about, it might even be in the 12 and 12, about how we often get off the beam. And that's almost a little reassuring to me, you know, because it's like, I can get off the beam, but the thing is, you know, when I've gotten in pain and when I've done, you know, made mistakes in AA, you know, because I've been in active and involved in a home group, you know, and because I've been sponsored, and because I sponsor others, you know, my reaction has been to go deeper into AA. You know, it hasn't been to walk out, right? Like, but if I wasn't doing all that stuff, when I hit those hard times, you know, if I wasn't doing that, I don't know if that would have been my reaction. You know, I gotta remain committed to AA. You know, I've been sober, you know, quite a long time, you know, but I still need AA. You know, I still need other people. I need the fellowship. I need the program of recovery as outlined in my book, or our book, you know, And, you know, I still need a sponsor, you know, and I talked to my sponsor yesterday, you know, he knows what's going on with me, you know, and I don't talk to him as much as I used to when I was newly sober. You know, I used to call him so much, like, at one point, I think it was like 18 years sober, and I still called him every day, you know what I mean? And he was like, you know, you don't have to call me every day, right? Like, I think you'll be okay, you know, like, And that was probably around the time I was 18 or 19 years sober. You know, my wife gave birth to our daughter. You know, and that was another big change for me, because I was so used to being available 24 hours, you know, for things in AA. You know, to be able to go to meetings all the time. You know, to be able to, you know, pick up and, you know, grab that newcomer, you know, and now I had other responsibilities as well, you know, and it was, I have to say, it was one of the hardest things I did, you know, was I had, you know, and, you know, my sponsors had kids, you know, for a long time, so I had this experience to lean on, and I had other people, you know, but it wasn't easy for me, you know. I was sober a long time, but I was not used to going to, you know, I started going like 3 or 4 meetings a week, you know, because my wife is also sober, and she's got to get to meetings as well, you know. And it was a big adjustment for me, you know. I had a really hard time for a while, you know. But I kept in the meetings I did get to, I talked about it, you know. And I'd talk about it with, you know, my AA friends, and I talk about it with my sponsor, you know. I've kind of found a routine that works for me now, you know, but even recently, you know, I haven't gotten to my home group because it's my wife's home group as well. I don't get to go there every week, you know. I get to go there every other week because we get to split it, you know, and uh, And and it's been interesting recently because I've been out of town, like I'm speaking here tonight, and I was in Philadelphia last weekend, and I've been out of town quite a few times, and I don't think I've actually been to my home group in a month, and I was talking to my sponsor about that yesterday, and and it's something, I can it's a home group I've been a part of for 22 years, almost, and I can sometimes walk in, and it doesn't feel like it used to, and that's not something about the group, I have to look at, that's something about where I'm at, and it's almost like, when I'm doing okay in AA, I can walk into a meeting and I can sit next to my sponsor, and if I feel like I can just sit in my chair, I'm usually doing all right. But if I feel like kind of antsy and I want to get up and go to the bathroom and I don't really want to be there, there's usually something I'm not looking at, so I talked to him about some things I can do about that, I got a lot of growing to do, I have an amazing life today, as a result of AA, and I don't want to forget, what got me that, I don't want to forget that I wouldn't, I don't know if I'd be alive today, I don't know if I would have made it this long if I kept drinking, so I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be sober. Thanks for letting me share.